This is VOA News. I'm Steve Miller. North Korea state media on Sunday said that it had conducted a state strike drill for multiple launchers, firing tactical guided weapons into its waters to the east in a military drill supervised by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un Saturday. Speaking on ABC's This Week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. wants to resume negotiations, aware that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants the United States to come up with a roadmap for nuclear talks by the end of the year.
We want to get back and begin to have these conversations. I don't know that there's anything particularly significant about his statement at the end of the year. We're watching closely the North Korean behavior, as are our allies, Japan and South Korea in the region. We still believe there's a path forward.
State media said leader Kim Jong-un stressed the need to increase the combat ability so as to defend the political sovereignty and the economic self-sustenance of North Korea in the face of threats and invasions. A Syrian military official says insurgents in the country's northwest are preparing for an attack on government-held areas. The comments on Sunday to state news agency Sana by an unnamed official came as rebel-held Idlib province and nearby areas were witnessing the worst wave of violence since Russia and Turkey brokered a truce in September. Syrian opposition activists, including the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and Syrian Civil Defense, say Syrian warplanes and artillery have pounded rebel-held areas in Idlib and Hama province. A Taliban suicide bomber detonated his explosive-laden car at a police headquarters in northern Afghanistan, followed by clashes between gunmen and security forces, then information coming from officials and the Taliban on Sunday. A provincial leader said that the death toll was not known, but at least 40 people had been injured. For additional stories as well as in-depth coverage, be sure to visit our website. This is VOA News. Gaza militants on Sunday intensified a wave of rocket fire into southern Israel, striking towns and cities and killing at least three people in one of the bloodiest rounds of fighting since the 2014 war. At least nine Palestinians, including a pregnant woman and her 14-month-old niece, have also been killed. Israeli Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus says a man has died from a Palestinian rocket, the first Israeli casualty since 2014.
The IDF holds Hamas responsible for every act of violence against Israel and Israeli civilians. We are prepared and ready to continue to retaliate against Hamas, and we are prepared for different contingencies.
Israeli forces struck dozens of targets throughout Gaza, including militant sites that the military said were concealed in homes or residential areas. The army also moved armored units toward Gaza as the sides headed closer to conflict. Pope Francis urged European leaders on Sunday to address wealth inequality and low birth rates, which he said had created an ice curtain between Europe and richer and poorer states and was fueling emigration. Francis made comments during a speech at the presidential palace in Sofia during his two-day visit to Bulgaria, his first and the first by a pope in 17 years.
Conosco l'impegno con cui I governanti.
Pope Francis said that he was aware of the nation's leaders' commitment, made 4 years, in the effort to ensure that young people, in particular, were not being forced to migrate. And he also encouraged them to preserve that path. Bulgaria, which joined the European Union in 2007, remains the poorest member state. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on Sunday that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is only ruling for the moment, despite last week's failed effort by opposition leader Juan Guaido to overthrow his regime. Speaking on CBS News Face the Nation, Senator Dick Durbin says Russia has contributed to the upheaval in Venezuela by sending soldiers in unmarked green army uniforms to support President Maduro.
They are destabilizing the situation there. They're there to support Maduro. They don't want to see the change that the American people want to see, and that's to have a free election in that country and a choice of someone democratically.
Top U.S. officials throughout the week praised the efforts to overthrow Maduro's government as its fall appeared possible, but Pompeo rejected the suggestion that the aborted takeover was a U.S. intelligence failure. Thailand's new king made a 7-kilometer march on Sunday, stopping at four important temples and weaving through the city on a route to the Grand Palace in Bangkok. From Washington, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
DFC has proposed three councils for the constitutional, for the transitional government, which are presidential council and cabinet ministers and legislative council. So these three councils are supposed to govern Sudan in transitional government.
Sudanese employees demand the firing of the Information Ministry's Director General.
People feel that it's possible that Ramaphosa himself cannot turn the tide around in terms of corruption and poor governance, and that it may be futile to actually vote for Ramaphosa, knowing fully well that it's really the party that needs an overhaul.
South Africans go to the polls Wednesday.
We want meaningful, trustworthy, honest, open dialogue with all the forces involved called onto the table for us to discuss. So I condemn this war in everything and put all the blame on Mr. Biya, that he stands accountable for the human rights abuses in this country.
And the Security Council plans to hold an informal meeting about the ongoing Cameroonian crisis. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Employees at the Sudanese Information, Culture and Tourism Ministry are demanding that the Transitional Military Council remove Ahmed Idein Ibrahim, the Director General of the Ministry. In a demonstration Sunday, the workers accused him of continuing the policies of former President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. The workers also said supporters of the former regime imposed on the ministry should also be removed or forced to step down. For more about their demand, I reach Mohammed Ali Fazari, columnist for Al Akbar Daily, a major Arabic newspaper in the capital, Khartoum.
The Director General of Minister of Information and Culture and Tourism has using the policies of the ousted regime of President al-Bashir, so he has dismissed many staff and also using a very tough policy with workers and over staff. So the Minister of Information and Culture, they said that they want to organize what they called elimination of suborn directors that who used to use a crackdown policy, and also they show they are faithful to the ousted regime of President al-Bashir. So this morning, over 100 staff of workers of Minister of Information organized a very big protest around the buildings of Minister of Culture and Information to show their protest and their rejection of the policy of the Director General. And also they called Minister of Information to overthrow the Director General of this ministry. They said that they have another escalation step if the authority will not take action against him.
This is not the first time this has happened, that they want this director at the ministry to be removed. Why has it taken this long, and why do they think that this time around the director will be forced out?
This is not the first time, as you know, that the anger grows against the ousted regime of President al-Bashir in many ministries and also the syndicates and the unions. You know, last week, the military council has issued a decree of dissolving all the unions in Sudan, particularly unions of teachers, doctors, and even the media. So these steps encourage people to start eliminating all the figures and what they call the old guards in the regime of President al-Bashir in ministers and government institutions. Some of them show clearly their face to the ousted regime, and some of them that using the policies of the ousted regime. So this is a step forward for eliminating and dismissing all those people. And some also went further, asking or demanding the military council to bring all those people to account. They think that they have committed a crime, some of them crime of corruption.
Do you anticipate more of this in other ministries or government institutions based on this anger that you are reporting about, and because of the success that protesters have had forcing out President Bashir's government?
Yeah, I was just now talking to one of these staff just an hour ago. They told me that they will escalating their wave of protest within the coming few days until the government, I mean the military council, to respond to their demand. They said that if the people were very clear and they're very responsible, no problem. But the people show that they are faced to the OSID regime, they are not accepted. And even their policy, they said that they are double standards during dealing with all staff and workers.
Mohammed, do you anticipate the military council looking into this and taking action, looking at the way the military council itself is negotiating with other opposition parties for a transitional government? Do you think that is serious enough for it to come to their attention to resolve it immediately, as these workers are demanding?
Yeah, unfortunately, that the negotiation has stumbled since last night. As you know, that there is a difference or disagreement between the opposition party, which are called the Declaration of Freedom and Change. There's some disagreement has appeared between this coalition. As you know, that the DFC is not one party. There are so many parties and civil society organizations. There are exceed 20 bodies inside. So as soon as they manage to overthrow the regime of President al-Bashir, some difference of ideology, of ideas on strategies of ruling Sudan has appeared. That's why the military council delays the response to the constitutional document that forwarded by DFC on how to rule the interim constitution, which is about 2 to 4 years. And also the representation between the civilians and the military, you know, council. As I know that the DFC has proposed 3 councils for the constitutional, for the transitional government, which are presidential council and cabinet ministers and legislative council. So these 3 councils supposed to govern Sudan in transitional government. But due to disagreement between 2 parties, the mediator has proposed another council, which is called National Defense and Security Council. So this is to be represented by 7 plus 3. I mean, 7 military and 3 civilians. While the Presidential Council, which is the highest level of the government, for the listener of Voice of America, I can just clarify, 7 plus 3 in the Presidential Council and also 3 plus 7 in National and Security Council. These 3 councils should be ruling the government of Sudan.
Mohammed Ali Fazari is a columnist for Al Akbar Daily, a major Sudanese Arabic newspaper. He spoke with me from Khartoum. South Africans go to the polls this week as political parties step up their campaigns in the run-up to the May 8 general election. Analysts say although the ruling party, the African National Congress or ANC, is set to win, its majority could be weakened. This as the main opposition in the Democratic Alliance announced it is ready to lead an alliance in the election to challenge the ANC's dominance. Wednesday's elections will be the country's 6th since the end of apartheid in 1994. For additional analysis, I reached Dr. Colette Schulze-Hessenberg, senior political science lecturer at the University of Stellenbosch.
After 25 years, we're expecting most likely a majority victory for the African National Congress, the Liberation Party that won the 1994 founding election in South Africa. We do expect, however, it's most likely that the ANC will be punished at this election. And what we expect to see is the ANC holding the majority of provinces and national governments. But the possibility of coalition governments is stronger than ever before.
Do you anticipate any of the opposition political parties talking about the Democratic Alliance, the biggest opposition party, or perhaps the EFF teaming up to pose a significant threat, possibly?
Look, both smaller opposition parties, the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters, increasingly pose a threat and have done over the last several elections. However, I think on their own, neither of them are likely to win a national election, nor are they likely to win provinces outright, except for perhaps the Democratic Alliance in the Western Cape province. That party has traditionally held the Western Cape for several elections now and will most likely do so again. But no, it's unlikely that the opposition parties on their own will win an outright majority. What we do expect, however, is that in Gauteng, which is the economic hub of South Africa, that particular province may well end up with no majority, and we may well see a coalition government there where an opposition party will have to go into some sort of government coalition with the ANC to hold that province. Or perhaps the Democratic Alliance and the EFF taking that province from the ANC for the first time.
Why would you think the ANC could be punished in this round of election? Haven't they delivered?
Well, we have to look historically at the last 10 years of governance under the African National Congress, but particularly under former President Jacob Zuma's rule. South Africans are terming state capture, where private interests connected to the governing party have captured various institutions of the state and outside of the state to enrich themselves. And these remain allegations, but are undergoing now criminal proceedings, prosecution and so on. And the criminal system is now clearly involved in pursuing a number of these allegations. So essentially, South Africans as voters have been exposed to increased allegations of corruption, maladministration. And
so, Dr. Schulze Herzenberg, don't you think the decision by the ANC to remove President Zuma and bring in Cyril Ramaphosa could prevent a possible hemorrhaging of votes from South African prospective voters this week?
There is the possibility of that happening. It's a mixed answer. To some extent, disillusioned ANC voters who grew disillusioned with the party under Jacob Zuma will certainly return to the party to give Cyril Ramaphosa a clear mandate to clean up government. And I think a lot of South Africans are behind Ramaphosa in this regard, and he's likely to pull in a lot of support for the party based simply on high favorability ratings of him alone. However, there are also many, many South Africans, many millions of South Africans who remain disillusioned with the ANC. And people feel that it's possible that Ramaphosa himself cannot turn the tide around in terms of corruption and poor governance, and that it may be futile to actually vote for Ramaphosa, knowing fully well that it's really the party that needs an overhaul. And there are questions as to whether he will be able to actually turn the party around, no mind the country. So it's a mixed bag, and we're not sure to this extent whether the ANC will do well at this election based on a Ramaphosa card, or whether in fact voters are going to choose to rather punish the ANC.
Do you think there is an appetite for an opposition coalition to really significantly challenge the ANC in this election particularly?
I think it's highly unlikely that a coalition between the two larger opposition parties will become fruitful, in the sense that the Democratic Alliance and the EFF are poles apart ideologically. They don't see eye to eye. The DA has a strong liberal history and, you know, wants to really minimize the role of the state in various programs in the country, while the Economic Freedom Fighters is pushing for the nationalization of mines and banking and so forth, and sees a very different role for government. So where we have seen coalitions at local level amongst these two parties, they've ended up being quite problematic and highly challenged. And I would imagine that at a national or provincial level, this particular coalition marriage won't end well. So it's unlikely. What's more likely is the ANC will go into an alliance with the EFF. We will see the EFF exercising far greater influence than it actually has at the polls through a coalition arrangement.
Dr. Colette Schulze Herzenberg is a South African political science lecturer at the University of Stellenbosch. She spoke with me from the Western Cape province. The United Nations Security Council is reportedly planning to hold an informal meeting on the crisis in Cameroon at the end of the month. Human rights groups say the ongoing crisis there has left 3 million people to struggle for food, with hundreds forced to flee their homes to neighboring countries, including Nigeria. Civil society groups say the Security Council needs to put pressure on President Paul Biya's government to find a solution to the crisis. For more on expectations for the UN Security Council meeting, I read John Fruindi, leader of the Cameroonian Opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF party.
Well, I want to thank the organizers of that meeting and their proposals, to congratulate them for what they're doing, to say those are good moves, but they are coming a little late because so many people have died of hunger. You have refugees in Nigeria. You have refugees in Cameroon itself, because in some of these areas, you don't have water. There's no electricity. There are not toilet facilities. And if they are doing this to really come seriously and look into the humanitarian dirt in Cameroon, I want to say thank you very much. Though late, please, you are welcome.
Mr. Frundi, some are saying you as a prominent leader, you've been an opposition leader for all this while. You should have contacted, at least engaged with President Paul Biya to help resolve this problem. They blame you as well for not, you know, putting pressure on the administration in Yaoundé because they think you carry weight to be part of the solution to resolve this crisis.
They have a right to say that because most of them are outdated. And I think that the VOA is an organization that is up to date with their news items. They know for how long I've been struggling to talk with President Paul Biya to no avail. I've written very touching letters to him. I'm on the verge of writing another one now. Mr. Biya does not want to talk to anybody. He cannot talk to the bishops. He cannot talk to the funds of the Northwest. If he snubs me to think that because I disgraced him in the elections by winning elections, which he sees, he will now disgrace me in what he's doing. He's instead killing himself and his own dynasty. So the people say that I've never made efforts. There's nobody in the country who's made desperate efforts more than what I have done. In a meeting in Yaoundé, when he greeted me and was going, I dragged his hand back and told him that, Mr. President, they're talking, you're not listening to this. Take note that when this struggle started, please sign what your prime minister had agreed with the teachers' trade union and the lawyers' union so that this will go back to their work. He said, Mr. Chairman, we'll see what to do. After that, I never stopped there.
Some are suggesting that the government has been making effort to engage in dialogue. And a few instances have been cited of the government making overtures for dialogue to resolve this conflict. What are your thoughts about
that? Like what?
Officials of the CPDM said there are ongoing dialogue with other opposition figures and opposition leaders in the country.
Excuse me, all those are just masquerades. Mr. Biya instead went and formed the bilingualism commission, which to me is a watershed masquerade, which means nothing. He formed the demobilization committee, which means nothing. He was supposed to sign what the prime minister agreed on with the teachers and the lawyers, full stop. The look of recent, the bishops had a meeting in Yaoundé, and they booked to see Mr. Biya. Mr. Biya would not want to see the bishops of Cameroon. So from the religious part, he doesn't want to talk. From the political part, he doesn't want to talk. And when he forms any organization to look into anything, they're all top officials of the CPDM. He wants people that will talk the language that will fit him. So he has destroyed the country.
Mr. Frundi, you talked about the fact that the anticipated UN Security Council meeting is coming too little, too late. But what are your expectations if the meeting does occur?
Well, if the meeting does come, because I just read the resolutions of the European Union on the human rights abuses in Cameroon, which were well written, well crafted, and in fact, even Cameroonians themselves couldn't have written something stronger than what I saw. But you see, Mr. Biya and his government are here crying that the European Union is blackmailing Cameroonians and all the like. They try to make Cameroon look as a personal property in somebody's pocket. Cameroon is part of a living world. And what is happening in Cameroon, as is happening in other countries, they are condemning. Why does Mr. Biya think that Cameroon is so special and is himself so special that they cannot condemn what he's doing, which is wrong?
So what is the best solution to the ongoing crisis?
We want meaningful, trustworthy, honest, open dialogue with all the forces involved called onto the table for us to discuss. So I'd condemn this war in everything and put all the blames on Mr. Biya, that he stands accountable for the human rights abuses in this country. And he has fulfilled all the conditions to be taken to The Hague for human rights abuses in Cameroon.
John Frundi is the leader of the Cameroonian Opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Meanwhile, on the occasion of World Press Freedom Day, journalists in Cameroon are protesting what they see are abuses by both the government and separatists fighting for the independence of the English-speaking areas from the majority French-speaking country. More than two dozen journalists say they have been arrested or threatened since the separatist conflict began. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from Yaoundé.
Hundreds of English-speaking journalists in Cameroon took part in conferences and peaceful protests Friday to talk about their experiences covering the separatist conflict in the English-speaking areas. Journalist Geraldine Fobang, president of the Cameroon Community Media Network, says police detained her on March 14 for leading journalists in a peaceful march demanding their right to be respected.
I stayed under incarceration for over 3 hours. I was molested and intimidated. The atmosphere is not free and fair for us to practice journalism. We are just afraid. It is my wish that stakeholders give peace a chance and provide us an enabling environment to practice as journalists.
Journalist Macmillan Ambe says he was abducted by separatist fighters in the city of Bamenda last February after he criticized their call for families to keep their children out of school.
They followed my TV productions over Waka Africa TV, and they said I was canvassing for school's resumption. When you do an article, separatists or the military, they want to get facts to show that you are supporting A in this article or that you are supporting B in this article, and at the end of the day, it becomes very worrying.
The Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists says many reporters in the northwest and southwest English-speaking regions have either abandoned their profession or fled to safer localities. Amos Fufang, former reporter with the Guardian Post newspaper, fled to the United States after he was arrested with three other journalists and detained in a prison in Yaoundé for 6 months. He says he was released after authorities investigated all his articles and social media accounts.
The day I was actually being released, I was told that I should refrain from reporting on the Anglophone crisis. And that's why after my release, I decided to stay mute.
Since the separatist crisis began in 2017, at least 15 journalists report they have been threatened by separatists. Authorities, meanwhile, have arrested at least 12 reporters and charged them with terrorism or propagating false information. All but one have been released. Dide Kaba, director in charge of media affairs at Cameroon's Ministry of Communication, rejects the idea journalists are persecuted by the government.
Les données qui sont à jour sont celles.
He says the fact that Cameroon has more than 500 newspapers, 150 radio stations, and 20 television channels indicates the media is thriving and that journalists practice their profession without any intimidation. However, in its 2019 World Press Freedom Index, Reporters Without Borders ranked Cameroon 131st in the world, down 2 places from 2018. It said arbitrary detention and prosecution of journalists continue to be frequent. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Ugandan opposition parliamentarians have condemned the government for issuing orders which they described as draconian, with intent to clamp down on media freedom. Diplomats from the European Union and the United States also raised alarm about the clampdown. This follows an order for the immediate suspension of 39 producers, heads of programming and heads of news from 13 media houses for unethical content. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached Charles Mwangui Mpaji, bureau chief for the East African, a major weekly regional newspaper in the Ugandan capital Kampala, and began by asking him about the reaction of journalists.
Shock, outrage, anger over what's apparent institutional overreach, which goes beyond regulation, to literally trying to tell media houses to draw a list of who should work and who shouldn't work in a media house. Because if you issue a list and you're asking media houses to suspend not one, not two, but three plus staff over coverage, especially of live events. And this came out a day to World Press Freedom Day, and we are seeing an increasingly hostile regulatory environment for the media, but also the media in Uganda is coming from a background where the police has been attacking and brutalizing journalists in the course of duty. So it's been outrage, shock, and disappointment.
The Uganda Communications Commission have the mandate to order the dismissal of journalists.
The Communications Commission is relying on Section 41, Subsection A of the Communications Act, which is a generalized section that talks about failure to meet minimum broadcasting standards. Now, the problem is that the Uganda Communications Commission is acting as the prosecutor and the judge in their own case, and they are not giving the media houses opportunity, or the journalists they are attacking, to defend themselves, to explain what's going on. But they are also, I think, giving a very broad interpretation to that section of the Communications Act.
This action has been condemned by some members of the opposition in Parliament, by the diplomats based in Uganda from the EU, US, and another 14 countries. What's the likely reaction from the government?
This one single action is part of the pattern of the Uganda Communications Commission. So any condemnation, any push for the UCC to pull back, I should look at the broad way the regulator has been overreaching its mandate. I don't think that the UCC, in its current formation, is going to take any significant steps to improve the operating environment for the media. They might go slow on the implementation and the enforcement because the media houses themselves are challenging this. Lawyers have challenged it, are taking this to court. So that might give some temporary relief. But generally, the EC has been trying to file as much pressure on media houses as possible, especially on the coverage of live events and particularly live political events. In the wake of increased protests against the government by the opposition.
What does this say about the environment and the general state of media freedom in the country?
The media is in a difficult position. These actions promote self-censorship. Media houses are under threat because the licensing regime is also was changed to giving annual licenses. So they are kept permanently on tenterhooks, not knowing when the regulator might strike or not strike. So generally, you can say that the operating environment for individual journalists and for the media broadly is critical and moving closer and closer to a more unpredictable environment as we move towards the next election in 2021.
Charles Mwanguya Mpaji is the bureau chief for the East African, a major weekly regional newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Last Sunday, Kenyan athletes Eliud Kipchoge,
Kipchoge and Brigid Kosgei won the London Marathon in the men's and women's categories respectively. Kipchoge, an Olympic champion, retained his London Marathon title for a record fourth win with the course record time in the British capital. The 34-year-old world record holder tactically shed off Ethiopians Mosnet Jeremiu and Mule Washon with 3 kilometers to go to claim victory in 2 hours, 2 minutes and 37 seconds. Kipchoge's feat saw him break his own course record time of 2 hours, 3 minutes and 5 seconds, set with victory in 2016. It's the second fastest time in history after his world record time in Berlin of 2 hours, 1 minute and 39 seconds. In the women's race, 25-year-old Kosgei, who won Chicago Marathon 6 months ago, pulled away from defending champion Vivian Cheruiyot after cruising past the 35-kilometer mark to win in 2 hours, 18 minutes and 20 seconds, becoming the youngest female London winner. Kosgei and Cheruiyot engaged in a thrilling exchange of lead as they passed 30 kilometers, with Kosgei leading by 2 seconds. Kosgei built her lead passing the 40-kilometer mark to win and exact revenge on Cheruiyot, who beat her last year. Pocket Rocket came second in 2:20:14 with Ethiopia's Rosa Dereje completing the podium finish in 2:20:51. Still in athletics, Kasta Semenya won the 800 meters at the Doha Diamond League meet on Friday amid speculation over her future. The win came just 2 days after the South African, who is 28, lost a landmark case against athletics governing body. Semenya challenged IAAF rules designed to limit testosterone levels in female runners, but the Court of Arbitration for Sport rejected her appeal. The Doha meet was Semenya's final race before the IAAF's new rules come into force on May 8th. Victory in the opening Diamond League event of the season was her 30th in a row at 800 meters. The double Olympic champion showed no emotion as she crossed the finish line in the fastest time of the year and a meeting record of 1 minute 54.98, having dominated the race from the start. Burundi's Francine Niyonsaba finished second, with the United States' Asia Wilson coming third. Semenya can appeal against the Court of Arbitration for Sports ruling to the Swiss tribunal courts within 30 days of the ruling. Finally, in boxing, world heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua will take on Andy Ruiz at Madison Square Garden in New York on June 1st instead of American Miller, who was replaced because of failing drug tests. Joshua, the IBF, WBO and WBA world champion, has not fought since his impressive stoppage win over Alexander Povetkin in September. In his only world title shot and defeat to date, Ruiz was beaten on points by New Zealand's Joseph Parker, who later lost his WBO title to Joshua. Ruiz, a 29-year-old Mexican-American based in California, is bidding to become Mexico's first heavyweight world champion. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sport. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you're hearing from Ali Kiba with Lupela. Then follows Askante with For Me, Dibange. Comes next with Oliver Twist. And then we will end with Makoma with Napesi.
You. Patimas Cante.
It's Masterell on the beat, baby.
Big up, baby, baby. You know you my baby, baby. I just want you to love me, love me. Want you to love me, love me. Hey, come on, take control. You know I'm your Tesla. Treat me like your queen, yeah. Always and forever. The way you do, you drive me crazy. I'm a fool for you, easy. Every day I call you daddy. I got love for you, me got love for you. Hey, you take my breath for. Drive me insane with that good formula. You did solve my problem, yeah. I no go ever let you go. I love the way you treat me so. You got my heart and soul. And I want you to know the way you do. You drive me crazy. I'm a fool for you, easy. Every day I call you daddy. I got love for you. Me got love for you. Fool for you, easy. Every day I call you daddy. I got love for you, me got love for you. You take my breath away, away. I won't go away, away. I just wanna stay. Love me for who I am. Love me for me, oh. Love me for what I am. Your sweetie, oh.
Jazzy.
You like it too, Baba, and you like Pali Kupa, and I know you love croissant, but you know you sing his song. I thought as much you know, I do not blame you though. You wanna add them on, you know it's wrong, but the truth is that you're just an Oliva.
Oliva, Oliva,
you just an Oliva.
Oliva, Oliva,
you just an Oliva.
Needy bum bum, shaky bum bum.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa.
for the sixth time since the end of apartheid in 1994, voters of South Africa will go to the poll this Wednesday to elect the parliament. As there is no direct election for the President of the Republic, the parliament or legislature will make this election depending on the distribution of seats in parliament, meaning that the majority party or a coalition will determine who the president will be. There is great uncertainty about the outcome of this crucial election. It appears that South African voters are very unhappy about their economic situation, particularly the black population. There are many continuing complaints about failures in service delivery. Also question about massive corruption in the society and failure by the government to redress what they see as the inequality in the society. One of the reasons that propelled President Ramaphosa from pushing out former President Jacob Zuma was to give him some opportunity to leave his mark in the electorate before these elections. However, it doesn't seem that this has made much change because the disagreement or the belief that the ANC is not working for their interests still stands among the black population. At the present time, those who are strong supporters of President Ramaphosa within the ANC are fearful that unless the ANC does very well, he will be faced with constraints within the ANC from the forces supporting Jacob Zuma. Therefore, they believe that it will be preferable for the president if the ANC should obtain about 60% of the votes on Wednesday. Currently, the opinion polls are showing that the ANC are ranging between 58 to 61%. The other problem now is how will the Democratic Alliance, the main opposition party, perform? While the ANC has been losing support since 1994, the Democratic Alliance has been gaining votes, particularly in the last regional election. The Democratic Alliance was formed in 1994 by whites who did not support the end of apartheid. However, it has changed and is now under a black leadership. Nevertheless, there seems to be disagreement within the party as to what should be their focus. Should they hold on to the white support or should they appeal to the black majority? In any event, the assessment in the opinion poll is the Democratic Alliance may garner not more than 22% of the votes. If we turn our attention to the economic freedom fighters of Julius Malema, we have a new problem. As is known, Julius Malema was once the youth leader of the ANC, and when he was expelled from the ANC, he formed the EFF. He has been able to appeal to the grassroots of the black population, although many believe that the party itself is led by middle-class blacks who live very well. Julius Malema has been able to articulate the grievances of the grassroots. For example, he say believes the ANC has not done much on the land issue, and he has proposed and is pushing the seizure of white lands and farms and not without compensation, arguing that it's unacceptable for the white minority to own more than 90% of arable land in South Africa. He is also calling for the nationalization of the mines. He has been a bone in the throats of the ANC within the parliament, but again, the opinion polls show that he may only obtain about 10% of the votes. So under these circumstances, it is not clear what will happen in the coming elections. That is why many commentators believe that the elections will be a fork in the road in South African politics. Even if it is agreed that the ANC will emerge the majority party, it may not be determinative if it doesn't have a greater majority. And it's because of these factors that there is a closely watched system, not only in South Africa about this election, but also in the wider international community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, an ugly child of your own is more than a beautiful one belonging to your neighbor. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.